Kia ora. Welcome to Primary Voices, a podcast brought to you by New Zealand doctor Rata Aotearoa, where we talk to people in primary care about issues important to them, right here, right now. I'm Zara Shartar-Masebi, and today I'll be talking contraception with South Auckland GP, Ona McGinn. Dr. McGinn is based at Pakuranga Medical Centre and has a strong interest in women's health, particularly contraception. She has long been leading the call to make access to different types of contraception equitable for New Zealand women. She's worked at a free contraception clinic in Mangere, teaches women's health at the University of Auckland, and is currently the Clinical Director of Primary Care Women's Health at Auckland DHB. Welcome, Dr. McGinn.
Well, kia ora, Zara, and thanks very much for asking me to talk on my favourite subject.
So, Ona, what are the issues when it comes to contraception in New Zealand?
Contraception in New Zealand has a few issues which impact on women's ability to access the contraception of their choice. So, first of all, there are quite a small number of funded methods. And as you know, Myrene only became funded last year. And of them, the most effective methods, which are LARCs, the implant copper IUD, and Myrena, their insertion is not funded. So even though you may choose one of those, because GPs, as a rule, are not funded for contraception, they have to charge their patients the time and the materials. And this is generally around $150. And so that is a huge barrier for some women. And I always liken it to as if insulin was funded, but testing strips and needles were not funded. You know, you wouldn't fund half of a treatment and not the other half. It seems absolutely bizarre. And again, Pharmaca are really aware of this, and they are, you know, there has been some lobbying. The other issue is that GPs compete with family planning in a way. Family planning is a not-for-profit organisation which has been in New Zealand many, many years. They've got highly trained nurses and clinicians, and they offer contraception free for some women, ages 22, who hold a community service card, hold a community service card, and it's heavily subsidised for others. So New Zealand Family Planning have always received funding, but primary care hasn't. So you get this situation where, depending on women present for the same issue, they will be charged different amounts, and that probably shouldn't be the case. And it's led to a loss of skills in primary care. So that is an issue there. And then, of course, the other issue that we were mentioning earlier is that there's no training to insert and remove LARCs in primary care. And this has been a huge failing. So when I began looking into this a few years ago and surveyed GPs as to how they had learned how to insert Jadel's IUDs, a large number of them had either learned just from watching a colleague or learned from watching YouTube videos. And, you know, in this day and age, that is not appropriate. You know, when you mention this to patients, the look on their face is, you know, really quite something to behold, to be quite honest. So I think the fact that there hasn't been a training scheme in New Zealand up till now is really poor. But again, that is going to be addressed. And I think we'll see women gravitating to clinics and GPs where they have undergone the training. It's not just the practical training, as we know. It's the ability to fully counsel, because you know the risks, benefits, the pros and cons. So it's more than just putting in or removing a device. So those are really the main issues. But between them, they have had an enormous impact on uptake of LARC in this country. A very small number of women use long-acting contraceptives. We don't actually know why, because the other problem in New Zealand is data collection. So since the beginning of the year, I've been chairing a group for the Health Quality Safety Commission, which is an atlas of contraception variation. And we've been looking at the variation in contraception provision around the country. But one of our issues has been that there's very little information. So because IUDs and implants are on PSO, you know, patient supply order, so they're kept in a practice, not attached to an NHI, we've got no way of knowing how many of these are inserted, or, you know, by whom or to whom. So this has been a huge problem. So far, Myrena is not on PSO Pharmac, when they funded it, did this deliberately such that they could gauge the uptake, which I can tell you is 5 times what it was before it was funded, which shows you that cost was an enormous barrier. So data collection is going to have to be addressed as well if we're going to be able to monitor, you know, any policies that are put in place to make contraception more easily accessible.
Recently, Family Planning did a survey, Contraception Use 2020, and it found that 25% of women weren't using their preferred method of contraception. How did that make you feel? I mean, was that surprising? Or, I mean, given what we've just talked about, it's probably not hugely surprising.
Looking at the survey, the majority of women were New Zealand European, where we know that cost is not such a barrier as it is to a Maori and Pacific population. So with that in mind, 25% sounds high, but I suspect if this survey had been representative of the New Zealand population as a whole, I think we would have found that it was actually a much higher proportion of women unable to access the contraception of their choice. I mean, we know from, you know, the biggest studies that have been done on thousands of women in the US, that if cost wasn't a barrier, more than 70% of women of all ages would use a LARC. I wouldn't be surprised if that was the situation here as well, but we know that probably more like 8% of women are using a LARC in New Zealand. There are multiple barriers which need to be addressed.
And being based in at a practice in South Auckland, where there is, I guess, a higher proportion of Māori and Pacific women, what are some of the other challenges that face them other than the cost barrier? Like, are there other reasons that prevent them from accessing contraception or LARCs in particular?
So when I was working in the free contraception clinic in Mangere in South Auckland that we set up with Counties Manukau, so 85% of those women were Māori Pacific, and we would talk a lot about the barriers that they faced to accessing contraception. So we would have women coming in who had an implant, say, inserted after their last pregnancy while on the ward, because they do a lot of postnatal contraception there, but haven't been able to afford to remove it. So these women, some of them were, the implant had been in 6-7 years, and it's only meant to be in for 5 years because they couldn't afford the $150 to go to their GP to remove it. So that was very sad, because it sort of showed that they hadn't been given the information about when this goes in, this is how you can get it removed. So that these women, they may have transport difficulties. Often they have larger families, so they've got children to bring with them to appointments. Not always easy to come backwards and forwards to contraception appointments. Sometimes they, there are cultural factors where sometimes it's difficult within for them to talk about contraception or women's health issues. They really appreciated having a clinic in the community which was dedicated to that. It was a real privilege to work there, actually. And the other good thing about the clinic was being able to address any other women's health issues that they had, because, you know, obviously in our, particularly in our Pacific population, heavy menstrual bleeding and endometrial hyperplasia is an increasing issue. And that is something that, we could address as part of our consultation if they required a PIPEL, because they had a increased in endometrial thickness on ultrasound. We could do that for them and insert a Mirena. So you could offer a lot of wraparound care. We could address their cervical screening needs. So it meant that we could cut down on the number of appointments that some of these women have to go through before their needs are met. For women presenting to Auckland DHB, we know that they need up to 7 appointments before their needs are met, because they need to, they can't access ultrasound in the community, they can't access funded iron infusion in the community. So they often are coming up and under hospital, which is very difficult for many of them. So, you know, these inequitable access issues really need addressing as well. Again, it's just too difficult. We're making it too difficult. There are too many steps, there are too many barriers. We talk a lot about it, but very little is done. You know, I've been auditing to death the referrals and here in ADHB and where I work part time in the women's health department, and it is very sad actually the inequity. You know, with women being referred into Auckland District Health Board, 14% of the women who are referred in have a with urogynecological problems, 14% are are mild and Pacific, with pelvic pain 12% are mild and Pacific, with abnormal uterine bleeding 66% are mild and Pacific. And those women's needs are not being met. They're having, as I say, to make multiple visits to hospital for things which should be available in the community and are available in other DHBs.
Since I've been in the job just under 2 years now with New Zealand Doctor, I've had quite a few conversations with you about contraception and contraception use in New Zealand. And last year you submitted a petition to the Health Select Committee asking for Pharmac to fully fund devices like Mirena with no restrictions. And so you're clearly very passionate about women's health. And so what drives you, you know, to seek to create change in that space?
If we're talking about why I'm interested in women's health, I've been a GP now for more than 20 years, and I was lucky to train in the UK, and I did some extra gynaecology as part of my training, so I did nearly a year, and I just really enjoyed it. And in the UK, you can also do additional training in contraception and family planning. So I also did the extra training there, which meant that I gained what they used to call a letter of competence in IUD insertion and in implant insertion. And I did the extra sort of diplomas that you needed to get the background knowledge. And I just ended up seeing such an enormous number of women who were helped by free contraception, which is the way it is in the UK. I mean, so much of the time as a GP, you're dealing with uncertainties, things you can't always help. You can offer a listening ear, and you can do as much as you can, but a lot of problems, obviously, I think we've talked about this before, they're down to the sort of social determinants of health, and there's a limit to what you can achieve, and there are very few medications which offer a sort of 99% risk reduction in whatever they are treating. But this is what contraception does. So it's actually a nice feeling to be able to do, you know, what it says on the tin. If you're offering contraception and you're actually doing a good job, people go away happy and confident that they've got the solution that they wanted to their problem. So I suppose when I came to New Zealand, I saw that there was a little bit of a gap there, that the landscape was quite different. And the more I got involved with women's health, I suppose the more irate I got about it. And so that's really how I ended up in this space, just sort of trying to advocate for better access to contraception for women.
Yeah, why do you think there seems to be such a difference in how contraception is accessed for women? Is it just that New Zealand is a smaller country?
I don't think we can just put it down to that, Zara, because, well, I've been here 10 years now, and I think the New Zealand health system, by and large, is excellent. I've really enjoyed working here as a GP. I've got more time to speak to my patients. I think ACC is a, you know, works really well, but I've been pretty stupefied actually by the sort of black hole where really basic women's health, and in fact public health, should be. Why is that? I think there's a variety of reasons. What I've come to realize is that contraception is seen as a privilege, actually, rather than a right in this country. I've spoken to a lot of health funders, planners, and managers, and the prevailing attitude seems to be that if you can afford it, you should have to pay for it. So it's definitely not seen as a public health measure at all, when in fact contraception is a really basic public health measure, like vaccination. I mean, if you had children not being vaccinated because their parents couldn't afford it, there would be an absolute outcry. And obviously that would have knock-on effects then for the public health of the whole country. And that's exactly what the poor access to contraception has created. The fact that a lot of women can't afford the contraception of their choice is one of the reasons why New Zealand has the high rate of unintended pregnancy that it has, which is over 50%. And that in turn has a knock-on effect because unintended pregnancies are more likely to be small for gestational age, they're more likely to be premature, the mother is more likely to suffer complications. All of these things are expensive for the health system. So, you know, we're not just being kind, saying that women should have free contraception. It's actually a cost-saving public health measure, and it's been very difficult to have that point of view widely accepted. I do think it's changing. again, having had conversations with various people over the years, the senior leadership team of the HQSC, who I spoke to recently, they said that previous governments had been quite opposed to wider access to contraception for various reasons. And it's really only the last few years it's even come up the agenda as it even being part of the sort of health discourse. So as I say, I think things will change, but it's a really slow process. It hasn't really sat anywhere either. That's been the other issue. I suppose, again, coming from the UK, as I know a lot of New Zealand GPs do, there is a faculty of sexual and reproductive health, which is part of the Royal College of Obs and Gynae, and it specifically looks after non-specialist areas of women's health, such as contraception, menopause, that sort of thing, which obviously is a huge part of GP's workload. I mean, for a female GP such as me, it's probably 40% of my workload. So anyway, there is a body that looks after this work in the UK. They issue the guidelines, they organise the training in women's health, and there's never been that organisation here. And these are the areas which fall between two stools, really, because it's not really looked after by RANSCOG, the Obs and Gynae College here, and it's not traditionally been high on the agenda for the GP college here either. So there's not really been anyone advocating for it. But what is, you know, what I can tell you is within the last 6 months, there has been a new college set up. So that's the New Zealand College of Sexual and Reproductive Health. This college, it's very new. I'm one of the board members, and we are very committed to this college providing advocacy in the sexual and reproductive health space and support for clinicians, nurses, doctors, midwives who want to provide this care and to be able to offer training and sort of best practice advice. So, you know, we're really hoping that there will be some changes. So the college is going through the process of being signed off by the medical council at the moment. We're hoping that will be done by the end of the year, and that college will then take over the training of the specialist reproductive and sexual health workforce, which is a very small workforce, which up until now have been trained by family planning.
On that, where does the responsibility lie?
Well, I think with most sort of health advocacy, it can't really be successful if it comes from one body only. And certainly women's health and contraception crosses an awful lot of boundaries. So when I was sort of advocating for Myrina, that was certainly not me on my own. That was RANSCOG, that was the GP college, that was the Child Poverty Action Group, that was a sort of multiplicity of people. And I think that it would be a similar approach if we were looking to bringing the issue of contraception access up to the fore. And it has been over the last couple of years. I mean, when the current government were first came into power 3 years ago, RANSCOG and the GP College and the New Zealand College of Midwives wrote to the government asking them to consider funding contraception. I think women themselves really should consider advocating. I think people just get used to the status quo. And if something is not funded, you know, you don't know what you don't know. If women don't know that in other countries, contraception is considered as a really basic human rights issue, access to contraception should not be, you know, discriminated. You should not be discriminated against and disqualified from free contraception, depending on your age, you know, domicile or ethnicity. If women don't know that what they're experiencing in New Zealand is inequitable, then they don't advocate for it. So I suppose it's just making these things a bit more widely known, isn't it?
And we've had that news that some of the pills are going to be out of stock up until next year. I mean, how do you feel about that, and what sort of implications might that have for New Zealand women, of which, you know, over 20, I think it's about 25,000 that are taking those pills?
I don't have the numbers offhand, but I do know that the contraceptive pill is still the most commonly prescribed form of contraception in New Zealand. Most of the time, if you go to the GP and ask for the pill is what you will get. To me, you know, a pill consult is an opportunity to discuss other options. And the majority of women have never had those discussed with them, I find. And if you do talk about it, you know, just give some food for thought, and a lot of women will go away and consider a LARC, which obviously has a lower failure rate and isn't affected by supply chain problems. So yeah, there's been a big issue actually with pills coming in and out of stock over the last 9 months or so, and this has really exposed just how vulnerable you know, women are to pregnancy if you cannot access your contraception of choice. At one point earlier this year, we were only able to issue, or pharmacies were only able to issue, contraceptive pills 1 month at a time. So we know that women, if they can't get their contraception of choice, or if it becomes difficult, they often just discontinue it. And I work in one practice in one area, I only work part-time, but I had two women fall pregnant during lockdown because they couldn't get their contraceptive of choice because family planning clinics were closed during the first lockdown. And we are expecting to see a number of unplanned pregnancies. Helen Patterson at the University of Otago is doing a study on this, actually, to look at what the effect of the disruption of the supply chain concerning oral contraceptives has been on the unplanned pregnancy rate. So I think if more women had the opportunity to use a long-acting form of contraception, and when I say opportunity, if it was offered to them and cost wasn't a barrier, the uptake would be higher. And we do know that from studies from abroad, if cost is not a barrier, the majority of women will use something long-acting. So this disruption in supply chain is probably an opportunity for those conversations. But, you know, along with the conversations, we need to be able to direct women to where they can go. And it's very hard for them to get the information. I have this conversation with my patients all the time. I ask them where they get their information from, and you know, a lot of the time it's from friends. There isn't like a trusted website that they would go to get impartial advice. And again, I think that's probably a bit of a gap that we could work on.
So I guess in some ways the supply chain issue is, there's almost a silver lining in that it opens up that opportunity for more conversations. But I mean, how challenging would it then be for a woman who, say, has been taking the oral contraceptive pill, say, for a year, to then have to be told she's got to change to a different method? I mean, do you foresee that as being a challenge, like having to take on a different method of contraception?
A lot of women are really amenable to changing pills. They really understand that there have been these supply chain issues. One thing I think is probably quite urgent is for Cerazette to be funded. So Cerazette is the progesterone only pill, which is much more likely to produce amenorrhea by suppressing ovulation in about 97% of cycles, as compared with Noriday, which is funded. And, you know, if we had the option, now that Noriday has had a supply issue, to issue Cerazette, that would be good, because Cerazette is, you know, Cerazette's recommended for a lot of things apart from just contraception. It's one of the first line treatments for medical management of endometriosis as well, you know, because it does have a higher chance of inducing amenorrhea. It's and you've got a 12-hour window in which to remember to take it, as opposed to a sort of 3-4-hour window with Noriday. So that, you know, that's quite an urgent thing, I think, for PharmAct to look at. And I think the Reproductive and Sexual Health Committee, that has been brought to their attention. But we don't have a huge number of options for different forms of contraception compared with other countries. You know, we don't have the vaginal ring, which is used, which is available in Australia and Europe. We've got Jadel, but we don't have this single rod implant, which is, more straightforward to insert and remove and seems to cause less bleeding issues. So we are a bit, you know, we're a bit stuck for options. And the options we do have, the best ones still cost money to insert and remove, and it's a huge barrier.
Having the contraception conversation with a patient, is that something that GPs struggle with?
Again, talking to patients, because I always, I never miss an opportunity to bring up contraception, and my patients do know this. And so if I see anyone who's of childbearing age, I always ask, are you all right for contraception? So, I mean, I just think it's an opportunity. And in fact, but it's become the culture actually in my practice. There are 12 of us, there are 3 LARC inserters, and we refer to each other. So I suppose in my practice, it's just a bit of a culture. And we've got 6 practice nurses, and whenever they're doing postnatal vaccinations for 6-week babies, they have the conversation with women as well. So we, you know, I think our patients know that we're quite a proactive sort of women's health focused focused practice. But I think it's, you know, it's not always easy. If it's not your area of expertise, you're not going to bring up something that you don't feel comfortable talking about. So I do find that with a lot of patients, they may have been going for years to a GP and getting the pill each time, and it's only maybe when they get into their 40s and they develop a second issue like type 2 diabetes or blood pressure, where perhaps being on the oral contraceptive pill wouldn't be, you know, the first or the safest option anymore. It's only then that Lark is mentioned. And so that has come up, you know, a number of times recently. I've had patients referred from other GPs because they've developed hypertension, and then, you know, when Myrina or something has been mentioned to them, they've said, oh God, we should have known about this years ago. So I think it's just keeping it in, you know, keeping it in mind that there's always there's always an opportunity to bring it up. Women don't mind, they like a bit of health promotion, which is basically what it is. It's, you know, it's health promotion. You know, I'm always pleasantly surprised at the number of women who say, oh, I never thought about that. And then they'll come back a few weeks later and say, oh, you know, yeah, I'm quite interested in a copper IUD or a Myrina or something like that. So, you know, whenever I'm doing my teaching workshops, I always say, just bring it up like you would smoking or, you know, any of those other health promotion things. Yeah, but so I think it's, you know, it's just one of those things about being just dropping it into the conversation.
The culture that you described at your practice, I mean, that sounds really great. Isn't that how all general practices should be in an ideal world?
Well, I think a lot of practices do work like that. You know, you'll often have GPs who've got a particular area of interest, maybe skin cancer surgery or, you know, joint injections, things like that. So I think within practices, people, or at least a lot of the ones I'm aware of, they do refer to each other. And I did a stint as the clinical director of our PHO, East Health. And this was certainly something that I was aware of, that within the PHO, there were GPs who had specific areas of interest and people would refer to each other. And I think that's a really nice way of working. You know, in some areas of New Zealand, that happens between practices as well. Like in Christchurch, for instance, they have a pool of GPs who specialise in things like skin cancer surgery or women's health. They can replace pessaries, ring pessaries, they can do larks, and they can refer between practices, and that is funded by their DHB. And I mean, I would really like to see that more widespread, because I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that not every GP can be an expert in everything. And I think it is perfectly reasonable to refer to a colleague who has a different skill. You know, I think it's helpful for the patient. And certainly if it keeps people out of hospital, it's, you know, it's better for everybody.
Because that's the goal, isn't it?
For me, it's definitely a primary care issue. Primary care is best positioned to provide that holistic care. It's, as I was just saying, it's an opportunistic, you know, intervention as part of another consultation or a consultation about something else. And women are not, you know, parceled up into preconception, conception, postmenopausal. You know, you've got women who are, you know, coming through your surgery at all stages of life, and you can offer contraception at the point, at multiple points when it's most appropriate for them in your surgery, without having to send them off to separate clinics. And now that, by the way, is not denigrating family planning, because I want to acknowledge family planning as the you know, the experts in this area who have really been doing the work in the community for many years. And the problem is they're underfunded, and they require, you know, more workforce and more clinics, because they're not available everywhere. You know, sometimes you can be 2 or 3 hours from your nearest family planning clinic. So that's why we really do have to acknowledge that there has to be a mix of services available, that has to be available in the community, not in secondary care. It's made too difficult for women, and it's not, and you know, I can't labour this point enough. This is absolutely basic public healthcare. This is not rocket science. It's cheap as chips. Contraception saves $10 or $11 for each dollar that is spent on it. And, you know, that's extrapolating from studies in you know, many other countries. It's just that it is not high on the agenda, and the initial, you know, capital outlay has not been there.
Say you were health minister, how would you change things in terms of contraception?
Well, the first thing I'll say is I couldn't think of a job I'd like least. Less. I think that would be a really difficult job. And again, I really acknowledge what a hard job being the Minister of Health must be, or working at the Ministry of Health. But I would definitely want there to be a focus on women's health with a life course approach, like there is you know, abroad, so such that the continuum of women's health is addressed, not just piecemeal things like contraception standalone, because these are issues which impact on women across their life course, maternity, you know, contraception, menopause, that we have to look at women's health in a holistic way. But one of the first things I would do is just make contraception free at the point of access, full stop. And, you know, you would see a positive flow on public health effect in maternal, mental and physical health, in child health. You know, the gains are huge. Women can access the workforce. It brings money into the economy because of women being in the workforce. You know, we know this, it's really basic. So I do hope that some gains will be made over the next few years.
The new College of Sexual and Reproductive Health, what are some of the things you're hoping that they will achieve once they kind of come into being?
So the college's primary focus at the moment is on the training for specialist sexual and reproductive health clinicians. That is the number one goal. And then our mission really is to advocate for better equitable access for women's reproductive and sexual health. And that really includes, you know, access to contraception, to menopause care, psychosexual medicine, pelvic pain interventions, things like that. So we really hope to be a repository of interest, of training and information for clinicians who are interested in those areas.
Training for LARC insertions is another important area, and with family planning about to roll out its own training program, do you think there'll be high uptake of such a scheme?
There's enormous interest in contraception training, enormous interest, probably more interest than can sort of, you know, be satisfied, to be honest. So family planning have been contracted by the Ministry of Health to deliver training in contraception, and that will be rolled out over the next few months. But it's unlikely to be able to, you know, reach everyone who has expressed an interest. And in a way, what you don't need is an enormous army of people offering the procedure, but only doing it a few times a year. You know, you maybe want sort of one person in each practice, or one person in you know, for a couple of practices who can do this, because we do know that you need to be doing a certain number of years in order to retain your proficiency. The UK sexual and reproductive health faculty recommend one procedure a month. And again, with no funding, that's not always easy to get, because women, you know, if you tell them how much it costs in general practice, often they will prefer to wait and go to family planning where it is cheaper. So, but I know that there's enormous interest. I'm doing a training workshop in Auckland in a couple of weeks, and we have 50 people signed up for that. So we reached capacity months ago. But then all of these people need to be able to get practical experience in a clinic. And that's not been set up yet, because we are waiting for the family planning training to roll out, to know that where we can do the practical training on patients. But hopefully this will get sorted over the next year or so. But as you say, with the change in abortion law, which came in earlier this year, the aim is for women to be able to access abortion in the community. And this really is going to be very difficult if there are no trained lark inserters in the community, because APGANS, which is the New Zealand abortion providers body, they've made it clear that they sort of wouldn't sign off an abortion provider who couldn't also provide follow-up contraception, including lark. So it's part of the wraparound package of care, which is what's provided in in the DHBs at the moment as part of abortion care. So again, if we don't have a lark training program and we don't have funded lark inserters in the community, I don't really see how we can effectively roll out this these new abortion contracts. But I'm sure that's being worked on somewhere.
Yeah, you'd hope so. So when you think about contraception in New Zealand and how it is delivered, how would you sum it up if someone said, give me the rundown on contraception in a few words?
Access to contraception in New Zealand is poor and inequitable. I think this is a great shame. It's old school. We're offering the pill to women when we should be offering the most effective methods first, which are the LARC methods. I think New Zealand could do a lot better as far as access and funding is concerned. I would really like to see this change.
You have been listening to Primary Voices, a podcast by New Zealand Dr. Rauta Aotearoa. This episode featured me, reporter Zara Shah-Tar Masebi, and South Auckland GP Orna McGinn. Thank you so much for listening. Keep your eyes and ears peeled for our next instalment soon. Ka kite.